Hello and welcome to The Events That Made Me, with me, Liz Taylor. As an international events planner for too many years to mention, I know how important certain moments in your life can be. So I wanted to speak to some of the most interesting people that I know and find out what events made them. And with every interview, you get an air extension, a bonus episode that digs a little deeper on something you can learn from my guests. Today's guest is a man that is a big deal to me.
Hello everyone, this is Martin Follard, the Editorial Director of MASH Media, and this is The Events That Made Me with Liz Taylor.
Martin Follard is one of those unassuming guys that you should never underestimate. He is a huge influence on the events industry. He's editor of Conference News magazine, which is a bible to those of us in the industry. He's seen it all, he's done it all, he's interviewed some of the greats in the business, including myself, of course. Oh, and he is in love with cars. And just for reference, we recorded this in the middle of the corona pandemic before it was announced conferences and events were going to be back in October. Hi, Martin. How are you?
Yeah, hi, Liz. Very happy to be online with you today.
I'm delighted to have you. And obviously, it's quite a different podcast for me today because this is very business orientated. You and I have known each other for a while. I contribute as a columnist in one of the magazines, but you've been a great support to me. And the thing that I like about you is that you are essentially a journalist, but you get it. You actually get the whole kit and caboodle. So we're going to come on to sort of how you got to where you were, and you're obviously very young to hold the position that you are, but let's just go back a bit, because I think that one of your passions started out in Dubai, is that correct?
It didn't start in Dubai, no. I mean, we're talking about motorsport. I've been infatuated with like motorsport, motor racing and everything involving four wheels, really, since I was a kid and started working at my local go-kart track in Surrey when I was about 15 years old, about turn of the century. And yeah, I started racing karts when I was about 13, so about 1997, something like that. So I ended up working at this go-kart track in Surrey for about 7 or 8 years before moving out to the UAE. It wasn't quite Dubai, it was the next emirate in Abu Dhabi, to follow my former boss to do the same sort of thing and work at a much bigger racetrack as well. But I used to race karts, you know, semi-professionally around the UK with, you know, some level of success, got a few trophies in the cabinet. But yeah, it was a real kind of high-octane thrill. I really did enjoy it. You know, dreams of being a racing driver like lots of other young lads and so on. But of course, eventually you run out of money for that sort of thing.
What was the 2007 Race of Champions? Did you direct that? Did you participate in it?
The Race of Champions is something that happens, kind of that goes around mostly Europe, I think. It's a big attraction series where Formula One drivers from past and present, rally drivers, you know, some of the biggest names in motorsport kind of come together for a display at the crowd. And what they do is they take over normally some manner of big football stadium. So in 2007, I was working for Daytona, which has owned the kart track at Sandown Park in Surrey, where I started working. And what they did was they took over the brand new Wembley pitch, and they actually built a race circuit within Wembley circuit, within Wembley Stadium, sorry, which was totally remarkable. And we were running six support races ahead of that. So we had to ship our carts up from the circuit and, you know, make the circuit safe. And yeah, we were dealing with lots of famous Formula One drivers and rally drivers. And we had members of the public and big corporates booked in to take part and race against them as well. It was a really surreal experience to have this racetrack built within at the time, brand new Wembley Stadium. You know, obviously you don't appreciate the noise it makes, the echo held in by the high-tiered seating just deafened you. It was absolutely fantastic experience.
Did you meet Stirling Moss?
Do you know what? I did, but not at that particular event. I met Stirling Moss actually at a hill climb race at Chelsea Walsh in the Midlands somewhere. Weirdly, don't take this the wrong way, I met him actually, we were in the loo together. That's when I actually met him. But he was a fascinating man.
I didn't realise you had such a black book of sporting celebrities, Martin. I think you and I better have a coffee and open that black book together. Out of interest, if there was one car that you could drive, what would it be? Because I'm a real car. I love my cars. And let me just tell you very quickly that when I bought Diane Lynn out in 2008, when I started work, and you know the whole story started with nothing and two young kids, and my one thing was to have a Porsche Carrera. That was my, you know, that was my goal. And when I bought her out in 2008, I went from the solicitor's office in Manchester City Centre to Stratstone's garages in Wilmslow, and I bought that Carrera, and it was like orgasmic. It was like the best thing that I have ever done. Unfortunately, the car, and I had three of them, did my back in completely. I ended up at the Alexandra Hospital. I had to have back treatment. So I'm now in the F-Type Jag, and I'm a car whore. I absolutely love driving. So what would your favourite car be?
Oh, well, I am, like you, a massive car enthusiast. I mean, straight off the blocks, the car of my dreams is the DeLorean DMC 12, which was the stainless steel, if you like, in car circles, monstrosity that lasted for about 2 years in the early 80s, obviously made famous in the film Back to the Future. And that's the thing, what I love about cars. You know, I'm a real car nut. I'm not interested in modern computer-driven boxes, if you like. I love cars that will go wrong, cars that have a character, that have a soul, that you, when you get in, feel like they're made for you. And I think the DeLorean just has that. I've never, ever sat in one. I've seen them, I've touched it, but I've never sat in one. And to drive one would be a bit of a dream come true, for sure.
Well, Martin, go on the Taylor Lynn website, because about 3 years ago, we did a Back to the Future private party, and we actually hired, we had outside the front of the venue, the DeLorean. And it is, it's a right bloody monster. So you can hire it. When it's your 40th, Martin, and we do your party, we'll hire it for you.
That is a deal.
So you moved on. You were involved in sort of motor journalism and journalism. So just tell us the story. Tell us how you got to where you've got today. And in that story, just give us a little clue as to what was the event that made you? What was the thing that sort of gave you the encouragement, the, you know, you're successful, you're very, very well respected. And this is not me looking for free advertising. This is me telling you it as it is. How did you get there, and what was the event that made you?
Well, it all does kind of tie in quite nicely when you step back and kind of look back and think about it, which I don't often do, to be fair. But if I were to kind of cast my mind back, you know, I always wanted to be a journalist secretly, you know, before motorsport took over my, you know, took over my life. But I always maintained an interest in it. And there was always that kind of maybe long-term plan to get back into it. But there was a catalyst. So back in 2011, when I was working at Al Ain Raceway, which is the track I worked at in Abu Dhabi, there was we were hosting a picked to host a big event, a World Championships of karting. And there was about 300 drivers from 180, I think, countries around the world. And, you know, 3,000 people we had to look after. We had to upgrade the circuit. It was a phenomenally difficult few months. We only got the sponsorship through in the August and of that year, and the event was in November. It was only a handful of us, and it was having to get the whole venue ready was a matter of massive intensity. The circuit had to meet new standards, and we had to have the car park expanded, and then I had to sort out, you know, a big marquee. Basically, you know, I was an events manager, effectively. That's what it was, although I didn't really appreciate I was part of the events world. And even on, I think, a week before the first cars turned up, my boss said, right, we're going to paint the building. So what? The building was huge and he wanted it painted. It was just chaos. But because it was such a big international event, we gained a lot of kind of national or local press interest. So I was the one who would be speaking to them and letting them know what was going on. You know, it was a massive boost to the little city's economy at the time. And you know, I decided that I would then build those relationships with those journalists, and I then started doing a lot of the race reports and basically becoming the, you know, the press officer for the event as well. And yeah, things sort of picked up. So I started doing, after that event, doing some freelance motoring journalism, because, you know, that was an easier way to get in. I knew about cars and so on. But if I was to look back at that event and say, it didn't make me grow to hate motorsport, but it did put me off it a bit, because I thought that we were so unorganized at times. I feel we could have done so much better. And it taught me to look at things logically and rationally. And I hold on to those kind of details today, really. So that was the event that really made an impact on me.
Do you think that identified the skills that you have moved on with? Because it's quite interesting when you go through a history, listening to you, it sounds like that you realized that you had better skills. You know, you had organizational skills, you understood, you identified. And do you think that that sort of was part of the process?
Yeah, absolutely. I identified those skills myself and thought, you know, I really think I can go somewhere else with this. And that's where I sort of pushed things. But that one event, it was a week long event, was the kind of the penny drop moment, I guess, when I realized that maybe I should be going in a different direction. But like you said, the lessons I learned from that, I still draw on today. When I look at the events industry and people running events, we went through hell putting that event together. And don't get me wrong, it was an utter success. It was a fantastic event, and credit where it's due to everyone involved to make it happen. But the sheer level and depth of things that we had to consider and look after and think about and then not think about and think about again was just remarkable. So I always remember that when I'm talking to events people and they just give me this top line stuff. I want to know the detail. What is the supply chain behind that? What's the thought process that's gone into that decision making? You know, that's the event I really do look at. And I try to apply those lessons to my journalism too.
Welcome to my world, Martin. My life's been total chaos for 30 years.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Follard, the editorial director of Mash Media, and this is the Events That Made Me with Liz Taylor.
What's the journalism story? How did you end up with, you know, editorial director, early 30s? It's quite an achievement. How did you get there?
Well, like I say, so the kind of race reports and motorsport press releases was how I started getting my name about journalism in the UAE. And I set myself up as a freelance motoring journalist and did a lot of work for some of the motoring magazines out there. So, you know, literally just getting a car on test and things like that. The idea the whole time was just to build up a portfolio of copy and stories and features and so on. I started writing a blog out there about, you know, life for an expat in the UAE as well. And that gained quite a bit of, you know, public attention, which was a bit of fun. But I got my big break when I got offered a job at Gulf News, which is the UAE's biggest English language newspaper. And that was one of the ones I was searching for full time. And I saw that pop up. It was one of those ones that you look at and you think, oh, I'm never going to get that job. But hey, you know, sod it. I'll send a CV in and so on. And would you believe it? A few weeks later, I got a call asking to come in for an interview. And there was one defining moment in that interview. So it was for a guides section, like city guides, that sort of stuff, that sort of journalism. And one of the questions was, you know, name sort of 10 things that you would like to see or read on the website. And I provided those in advance at the interview, and I was asked why I chose them. And I just said, because that's what I want to read. And that, because at that point I was a reader of the paper, that was the best market research they could have had. That's what I wanted to read, and that's what wasn't there. And I think that's what sealed it for me. So I got offered that job and took it.
That's probably the event that made you. Yeah, I would say that it was one of the events that made you. But you were there actually for what, 2.5 years?
Yeah, I would have been there longer, but my visa was expired and I'd got married and had a kid and we wanted to move back here. So that was the reason for leaving, nothing else. And I loved that job and it was intense, but I was part of the, you know, part of the web team. So I would do shifts on the breaking news desk. And I think I had a 3-week period where I dealt with 2 plane crashes and the death of Muhammad Ali. And, you know, you're in charge of the lead role in coverage of that. And it's intense and it's coming down on top of you. I then got promoted to web sports editor. So I was in charge of the online sports department there as well, because it was just, you apply a logic to what you're doing and you just have to understand what your readers want. And I really, really enjoyed that. But, you know, that they were hard lessons in hard journalism. And don't forget, we were getting sent stuff that wasn't really for public distribution. You know, things, people like ISIS were sending our newspaper, you know, videos of, you know, the most unimaginable horrors. So it was a real, you know, very, very tough, you know, job. You know, you had to be quite steely to deal with that. And I always kind of thought, well, nothing will ever be quite this difficult. And as I was looking for work, funnily enough, it was actually Mash Media who called me one day when I was on my way to accept a job at another magazine. And they offered me the job as deputy editor of Conference News. And then, well, Mash Media journey began.
What made you make that decision, why did you choose Conference News over the other alternative, other option?
Because I hadn't done any business journalism before. The other one was about was a motorboat and yachting magazine, and I thought it was quite similar to basically being car journalism. And I'd done that. I'd done hard news. I'd done city guides. I'd done sports. You know, I had done motoring. The one black hole on my CV was business. I hadn't done any business journalism, so I thought, hey, I'll take a punt on that. Sounds a bit different.
And were you responsible also for setting up the internet? Was Confex was in place then? Because I remember going to Confex when I very first started. So, and have you been responsible for the development and growth of that as well? It all seems to sort of work hand in hand.
We are hand in hand. No, I'm not involved with Confex on a practical level. At the most recent one, I was moderating the keynote theatre, but we are the same company. But of course, it's a great resource to share. You know, Conference News, you know, I'm proud of my magazine and the other MASH magazines, and it gives us access to some great speakers and great content. And Confex can bring people together, and our magazine can help facilitate that. So it was an established product, and it's improved an awful lot since I joined. And I say it's up there now as one of the top exhibitions, I'd say.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a great brand that you're working with. There are two types of people in business: the ones that make a big song and dance about themselves, and the ones that know their stuff. Martin Fullard knows his stuff. Hear how being the expert is a great way to quietly succeed in business and in the happiness stakes too. So check out the bonus air extension episode, which is in your podcast feed now. So Martin, go on, tell us, what's been the proudest moment in your career?
One of the proudest moments, I suppose, was actually very recently. In fact, it was Confex in 2020 in February, just before coronavirus really kicked off, where I had the privilege is the right word, to interview live on stage Fegan Murray, who's the mother of Martin Hett, who is one of the 22 victims of the Manchester Arena bombing in 2017. And obviously Fegan, as you may know, has been campaigning for Martin's Law ever since, which has been which would require tighter security at venues and bringing security to the top of the conversation. And for me, it was the most humbling experience to talk to her. My respect for her is boundless. She conducted herself with such dignity about an issue that so many event organisers don't give the right amount of consideration to, security, and particularly of what happened at Fishmongers Hall in November last year, where we had the, you know, two people tragically killed. Again, that happened at an event. It's happening in our world. And the way Fegan Murray was so open in talking to me and getting the events industry to understand was a real defining moment. For me, that brought everything together. That reaffirmed our importance of what we do.
I think you're absolutely right. I think that people do underestimate. I don't actually. My biggest fear, and this is, I'm sharing this with you, my biggest fear at an event, particularly in a marquee, is fire. I always have security, an abundance of security. But unfortunately, whatever security they'd had that night would not have made a difference to the outcome. That is fact, I believe. But that's very interesting. And I'd love to meet her. I'd really love to meet her. We should do something for that. Has that changed the way you think, Martin? What impact did it have on you?
That's a really big question, and it's a good one. So many people, there are a lot of journalists out there who don't understand the consequences of what they write. Perhaps they take for granted their job and what they do, and they think they'll just file, copy, publish it, walk away and forget about it. But it has an impact. It would last. It lands somewhere. And for me, that resonated. It made me think, you know what? Everything Fegan is telling me now is my job to relay. People will make their decisions based on this right now. And that could, down the line, save people's lives. It really did bring everything together as far as I'm concerned. It really did make it clear to me that I have one big responsibility and I must take that seriously.
Amazing. And at the moment, we're right in the middle of this horrendous epidemic, pandemic, whatever we want to call it. My industry, the events industry, together with the rest of the hospitality, has been, it's devastated the entire future at the moment. And you've been very active on social media and very, very supportive and very proactive. And I think it's fair to say that you and I are probably in the minority in that we've gone out there with this very positive cup half full approach, which I think is indicative of the brands. And also, you know, we will survive. And me as an event organizer will survive with publications like Conference News. But what do you think? Where do you think we will go with it? Because the industry has to survive, and I will, but a lot of people won't. I'm interested to know what you think.
Yeah, this is a real sea change moment for the industry. And I think this the biggest problem has been, and I've been vocal about this up until this crisis emerged, the events industry, we haven't got an identity. There's too many diverse moving parts. You don't feel together. Even at, say, look at an agencies. You can have one agency who specializes in venue finding and one that does creative services. You know, they've got nothing in common as businesses, but they're both agencies in the events industry. They have no need to collaborate. So they're not, we haven't all been swimming in the same direction for years. And that's been our biggest problem. This crisis, if there's any silver lining to find, has brought us in line. It has brought people together. I think most people working in the events industry don't even realize they're part of the events industry. And you look at corporates. If you're a corporate working for, I don't know, Barclays or something like that, you're not working in the events industry. You're working in the finance sector. You're running events in finance. So the events industry is this kind of the roots of the tree, I guess, you know, they are, it's under the ground, it's under the radar. And because we don't have a standardized industrial classification code, it's a bit of a mouthful, the government can't accurately track what economic benefit we actually do bring. We can work it out, 70 billion, that's what we're worth. And that's the figure accepted by the DCMS. But I've never been more confident that we have as an industry made progress to get awareness. And as we speak today, underneath one of the five task forces set up by the government last week, the events industry is part of the visitor economy group. And a strategy for guidance for the events industry is currently being worked on. The current tourism minister, who is the events industry's MP de facto, I guess, Nigel Huddleston, has a history of in our industry. He was head of travel at Google and Expedia, which is intrinsically related to us. So I've never been more confident that we have made an impact on government. The next couple of weeks are going to be crucial, and we need to have a distinction between mass gatherings and organized events. But I think that this crisis has been the kick up the backside that maybe the industry needed. That's my view.
I think you're right. I think that it has been a kick up the backside. And I think that the strong will survive. I don't think that there will be anything in terms of a large event for at least 12 months. And I think that's the biggest challenge that small companies, and small doesn't mean unsuccessful. So, you know, I've run it on a tight shoestring for 30 years, 5 staff, bought my own building. You know, I've really looked after the finances, but delivered some huge events, working very closely with those events team in the finance industry, in the legal sector, you know, all. And I think that there's going to be nothing for a year. I've actually, On a much smaller level, I've been promoting and I am producing an event called Hospitality Rise, which was going to be in October. I think that was a bit optimistic. So it's now going to be in April or May. It's at Victoria Warehouse. And it's for everyone in the hospitality industry. We're going to invite 1,000 people. And it's for all the people, the people that rely on sales, that, you know, provides them with an income. Everyone from top to bottom. It's a free event, and it's good. They'll pay for food and drink. We've got celebrity entertainment. But the reason I did it was because I just felt that even if we are, even with our competitors, we've got to have something to look forward to. We've got to all pull together. It's a very cliquey industry, and it's a very productive, creative, exciting. And we've created it. When I started 30 years ago, there was nobody in Manchester doing it. And it has to be saved. And it can only be saved with government support, because, you know, otherwise people are just going to be out of work and it will just dissipate. But, you know, am I frightened? Not really. I think I've had other things that have frightened me. But I think that we all need to pull together. And what was interesting, the point I was making with Hospitality Rise, is I've been approached by Marketing Manchester and other media agencies because they want to collaborate, because I think it's very important that we all pool our resources and bring it all back to life. But I don't think there'll be, I think it will be impossible for the government to define whether you can have 200 people, 1,000 people, or even 50 people at an event. And I don't believe, and I'll probably get shot for saying it, that there is an awful lot of merit in investing in virtual events. What's your view?
With regards to the virtual events and digital events, I think this is the really interesting thing for agencies. Particularly from corporates, budgets are likely going to be reduced for whenever events come back, end of this year, next year, whenever that might be. So agencies are going to need to deliver a lot more with probably less, as far as I'm concerned. And when it comes to digital events, we've got to, you know, people need to get out there this idea out of their heads that, okay, well, we'll just send a Zoom link to everyone and then that's it, everyone's involved in our event. No, the quality is going to matter of that digital experience. Now, there are some agencies who are already now investing in their own virtual venues, they're calling them, special studios to deliver a high quality product. You need good bandwidth. You need high quality. You need a proper presenter to do that. You need to make that experience worthwhile. And of course, it needs a rethink as well. You can't just have a whole day sitting in front of your screen. You know, you need bite-sized content, something that's more absorbed by people who are just sitting at their desk for short periods of time. No one wants to be sitting at their desk all day staring into the screen or the webcam. So agencies are going to have to be the ones championing that, I think. They're going to be the ones who need to learn and to need to educate the corporates and associations and whoever else that this virtual idea you've got, it needs to be quality. You need to think about it. It's not just flicking a switch from live.
And you do a huge event, an annual event, don't you? Tell us about the event that Conference News put on.
Which one are you talking about?
Is it the EN event?
The EN Awards, yeah. Our sister title, Exhibition News, is obviously the only real magazine dedicated to the exhibitions industry in the UK, runs the EN Awards annually. And that is a huge laugh. In fact, it was supposed to be on the 20th of March, which was when the lockdown rules came in. So obviously it had to be postponed. And that normally gets about 1,200 people. The last few years, it's been hosted at Battersea Evolution in Southwest London. And, you know, big black tie event. They get some very decent compares. It's always a bit of a blur at the end of the night. But it's a great, great chance to kind of get the exhibitions industry together and everyone has a good laugh, lots of backslapping. But you know what? That's when friendships are made, when business deals are struck, you know?
Absolutely. And that is hugely important. And the networking, you know, the networking element of our industry is key to the growth of the business. Will that happen next year? Will you do it next year? Have you postponed it? Have you planned for it?
I can't say when it's going to happen, but I'd be fairly confident that the minute events are allowed to happen, we'll want to get it done, because I think a lot of people in our industry are going to want to get together very shortly.
And in the meantime, Martin, what plans have you got? What imminent plans have you got for Conference News? What are you working on at the moment?
All manner of things. A readership survey has just come back to us with lots of results. So obviously we're delighted with a lot of the positive feedback, but it's certainly highlighted other areas of the industry that we need to explore in more detail. I think we need to be looking at technology as far as written features are concerned. There's a lot of people asking a lot of questions out there right now about what technology to use, how to make it work. Exactly the same conversation we had just a few minutes ago. So I think we're going to be focusing on that angle quite a lot. But of course, something else, you know, we've got to think about is contracting. It's very dull and boring as a concept on its own. But if you've pushed your events back already from Q1 or Q2 this year, there's still a chance that it might not be happening in Q3 or Q4, despite your best intentions. So are you contractually safe? What's your legal standpoint on that? Venues' goodwill can only go so far. They want to, you know, they need their takings as well. So yeah, contracting matters is something we're keeping a close eye on. But otherwise, it's top of the line stuff from Westminster, really.
I've really, really enjoyed this. And I'm on your side. And thank you for all the support you've shown the Taylor Lynn Corporation, because you've been a great advocate for us. I have huge respect for you and thoroughly enjoyed listening to the story. So we'll obviously stay in touch. And I hope to see you at the EN Awards in 2021. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Liz.
There are not many of the male species that I actually respect. But in this industry, Martin Fullard is the boss. He's a huge support to those that support him. And for that, I'm eternally grateful. So please make sure that you listen to the Air Extension. This one is about being an expert. Hit the subscribe or follow button so you automatically get the next episode in your feed. And if you loved this episode, make sure you leave a rating and a review on Apple Podcasts. And you can find me on all the socials as at Liz Taylor Consultancy. Tag me in and I will reply. You get a new episode of Events That Made Me every Wednesday. And my next guest is one of the most inspiring people I know.
And I stood there in the middle of the dance floor for, it's about 1 minute and 57 seconds, and went back and I said, what was that? He said, it's the new single from the Beatles. It's called Please Please Me. And I knew right in my heart, that moment, that was what I wanted to do.
From minor to rock star. No, it is not Billy Elliot. It is the legendary broadcaster, Mike Sweeney.